Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, where we aim to give you all the technology news that you'll need to meet your recommended weekly allowance. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week we have a feast of top quality content.
Hey there, folks. It's Chef Mark with your daily cooking tip. Today, I'm talking about rendering lardons.
I'm in Parliament Square, and I've bumped into Austin Mitchell MP, who's come down to take a look.
It's a question of persuasion, isn't it? The Sri Lankan government seems to be going for the kill.
There are no direct bus links at all to Cannes, 12 kilometres away, and only two or three bus journeys to the nearest small town Tayul, one of which arrives shortly after the shop closes. Thanks.
Now, before you try and change your dial, that wasn't the radio. It was a selection of audio booze, the products of the latest networking app that's captured the attentions of the tweeting masses. You may recognize Vic Keegan's voice, and also the person who was playing the piano was Rory Kathleen Jones's son, Rufus. We'll be speaking with Audio Boo founder Mark Rock about their novel new approach to raising cash, which some Luddites may think is taking the Web 2.0 ethos a little bit 2.0 far. Joining me to pick apart his business model is our resident number cruncher, Charles Arthur. Charles, what is your favorite business model out there?
I think the freemium model, the one where you give away sort of low-grade version, but you have the premium version as the paid for, I think is actually, of all the many, many business models out there, is the most effective. Far better than advertising, because advertising can just vanish. Far better than one where you have to pay for it all up front because you're not sure what you get. The freemium is a really great way of getting people to talk about it, but at the same time, jump in.
And also you get something for free.
Yeah.
Anyway, before Mark tells us how clever modern startups work the system to make some cash, we've got a special startup surgery. Have a great idea? Working on a new piece of tech? Terrified someone's going to nick it and don't want to pay the attorney fees to find out how to secure yourself? Our resident legal advisor is here to give you free, yes, free advice on how to protect your intellectual property. No, it's not too good to be true. We're also dissecting the latest news, talking about the tools that make MPs accountable to their constituents for their expenses, and how Twitter has helped start a revolution. Plus, the chatter from the blogs. A whole cornucopia of delicious and nutritious treats to keep your GI low and your technology knowledge high. Stick around. Picture the scene. You're a budding young web entrepreneur and have landed a peach of a contract. But in the process of toiling away for the company dime, you happen to develop a stunning piece of tech that you know will revolutionize the world. Who owns it? Can you run away with it and make a mint? Or is it the company's to exploit? Here's another one. You've developed a genius idea that's going to make you an e-star. Problem is, you need to get funding for it, which means peddling it around to potential VCs and, well, anybody else will listen. But for every person you pitch to, the more danger there is that someone else will either come up with a similar idea themselves out of universal synchronicity, or that some unscrupulous someone will implement your clever invention before you can raise the cash. How do you protect yourself? Well, these are just two of the questions that Jemima Kish asked on your behalf to Peter Finney, European patent attorney at Gill, Jennings & Every. The questions came pouring in via email, blog comments, and tweets. Here's the best advice that money didn't buy. Jemima started out by asking why protecting your intellectual property is important.
It's the only way in which you can stop the competition from competing with you. And if you're seeking money from investors, that's what they want to avoid the risk of. They want to avoid the risk of other people coming in and stealing your market after they've paid for you to develop something.
So it's about protecting your ideas, identifying and then protecting them.
That's correct.
Okay. A lot of the companies that have contacted us, a lot of the companies out there are obviously going to be working online and they'll be working with software. Software seems almost a kind of abstract thing. I mean, can you patent software? And also, when so many people are using content and services that are from the APIs on other websites and they're using open source, how does that complicate things?
You can. I mean, sure, you can patent software. There's a misconception that you can't, and there are a lot of people who think you shouldn't. But, of course, software covers a very broad range of applications and technologies. And for some of them, for example, a laser-guided missile, you would want to cover that, protect that software using a patent. At the other end, something like Facebook, which is a software application, there's nothing to protect because you can't protect all forms of software using patents. You can only really protect the ones that have some technical character to them, that solve a technical problem.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, a question from Supercar, who said, part of our website was copied word for word, about 1,000 words, and image, by a competitor. They even forgot to change our name on some pages. After contacting them several times, they agreed to take down some of the text and images. I've contacted Trades Descriptions, the police e-crimes department, who say there's nothing I can do about the further images and text, but would pay a hefty solicitor's bill and take them to court. What advice would you give Supercar?
Well, first of all, it seems on the just those facts that there's clear copyright infringement, and taking down part of it doesn't necessarily mean that they avoid infringement. So you could bring proceedings against them, and the person who suggested that is absolutely right. But it comes down to, again, money. I would advise that you go and see a solicitor and get them to send a warning letter. That would probably be enough. A shot across the bows would put them in their place.
And what if people are using a substantial amount of open source code for their website?
Well, open source code is subject to the open source agreements that are in place. You need a license to be able to use that. It's called the GPL. And that is an intellectual property right in itself. If you break the GPL, you get sued for copyright infringement. There's a great debate. Some people think that open source is the answer and that all software should be free. Other people think, no, the patents for innovation protect their inventions more broadly. And some people, like IPM, use a mixed approach. They will patent some things and provide other things for open source. And they've got one objective in mind. It's the same. It's to make money.
Brighton Rocks has got in touch, and he says, we're having a large website redeveloped and I'm reviewing the contract with our web supplier. The contract says that all know-how is copyright of the supplier and the information is copyright of the client, e.g. the text and the images. But these definitions don't recognise how websites are built in 2009. All the ideas for functionality come from us, the client, and we've co-designed the usability and process for some of the functions, so I'm reluctant to give the rights to any know-how which we've partly developed. What is the 2009 best practice for such an issue?
I'm not sure there's a new best practice at all. It basically comes down to what you can agree with the service supplier. We have a website in common with many law firms. We expect to own the copyright in the materials that's on it and the look and feel of the overall site. There are clearly tools of the trade, if you like, that go into designing a website, and we wouldn't expect to own those. It seems to me that the web designer here is saying that we're going to develop some materials for you, for your website, and it's right and proper that you should own all of that, because that's a copyright work. You wouldn't want them to go away and design a site for someone else that looked and felt the same. But they're tools. They have to be able to go away and use those tools to develop other people's websites, and that's right. But the terminology used there is clearly wrong, and the contract is wrong.
The next question is from Russell Mulligan, who seems to really be asking, at what point do we need an IP lawyer? So you're probably very well placed to answer this. I'm the joint owner of a small tech company. We recently put together a pitch to acquire funds for development and operating costs for an ambitious smartphone app and online platform. We have a nationwide client waiting in the wings to trial the product. When we met with some tech-based venture capitalists, they were keen on the idea, but we were told we needed to seek out angel investors for initial seed investment. Their chief concern was that we didn't have any patents and no one would invest in our outfit as it stood because a big company could copy our operation and leave us standing. So we've looked into the patenting process, downloaded the guides for claims, descriptions, drawings and abstracts, and are putting together our document as best we can. However, we just don't have the funds to pay an IP lawyer, and we probably won't get funding without a patent. So at what point can we approach potential investors and say such and such is in place? How many searches? What is the time frame? Help would generally be appreciated. I think they were getting increasingly more desperate.
That's a lot of questions, and I think our approach would be to get them in just to sort those questions out, because they relate to different issues to some extent. You've just got to get your patent application on file. You do not have to have a patent granted when you go to speak to investors, but you must have your patent application pending. And I think there's a misconception as to how much it actually costs to get a patent application filed. Typically, you're talking at £2,000 to £5,000. And I think if you don't have that, if you don't have £2,000 to £5,000 to file a patent application, then you can't have really much for business. And you can't expect other people to put money in at that stage. If you go and talk to, whether it's any form of private equity investor, if you go and talk to them, you could rely on a non-disclosure agreement. but that's just like a promise. It's a promise that I won't tell anybody. If they break that promise, there's very little you can do.
So if you're very new to the game, what can you expect when you go and see your IP attorney for the first time?
Well, you know, most good IP attorneys will invite you into their offices and give you at least the first hour free to discuss what your invention's about and understand your commercial objectives and make you aware of the different strategies and cost implications. But what you should expect is that they want to understand your commercial objectives, because that's really what it's all about.
And you've just gone into the costs for the patents. They're a basic patent, but how about the costs for the IP lawyer? I mean, it's likely to be a fairly substantial outlay for what could be a very small startup.
To get an application filed somewhere in the world, and where you file first is a matter of strategy, but to get an application filed is somewhere between £2,000 and £5,000, and that is mainly the cost of the patent attorney. There are no other lawyers required at that stage. That is enough to get your foot in the door, get you a filing date at the patent office, and then you can go and talk to people, preferably still under an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, but having filed a patent application, you've then started a process which gives you the right to talk to people.
And is the UK one of the best places in the world to file a patent? I mean, you briefly mentioned that there are differences kind of country to country, but what's the advantage to registering in the UK?
If you have a market in the UK, then you would want to get a patent in the UK. One of the things about the UK is it has a strong intellectual property system, and patent applications are examined thoroughly. So if you get a granted patent here, it's a good sign you've got a valid and enforceable patent. But what I was touching on earlier on is you don't necessarily have to file first in the UK. Your major market may be in the US. In fact, the investors that you're choosing may be from the US. And I'm thinking particularly for software and internet-based inventions, computer-implemented inventions. So you might be better to file there first because your competitors will be from the US.
Our last question is from Jonathan Hopkins, and this is really about how you protect a very early stage idea. I'm currently working on getting a prototype together for my first ever startup. I'm a definite newbie, but I'm terrified that someone I talk to in the process of trying to find investors and developers in the early stages will just copy the idea and get in there first. To date, I've asked anyone I talk to sign an NDA, but I have this nagging feeling it stands for nothing. And actually, one person I've talked to just flat out told me they didn't sign NDAs. I showed him anyway, as I valued his opinion, and since then I've been slightly more relaxed in terms of talking to people about my ideas. But I'm sure there's loads of people in my position. This idea has been brewing in my mind for nearly 2 years. What would you advise?
Well, I would advise don't relax. It's not a question of trust. You know, if you want to get a valid patent at some point, you must not have disclosed the invention before you file the application. So don't trust anybody. You're right, though, an NDA is only as good as your ability to enforce it. And if the cat's been let out of the bag, that's it. There are very few remedies for you. Don't tell people. Keep it to the minimum number. Make sure they're covered by an NDA. And if you can't get them to sign an NDA, and many companies won't sign NDAs for very good reasons, file your patent application. I've already said it's not that expensive, but it gives you that freedom to go around talking to people openly and honestly, not trying to hold back.
Do you think sometimes that the complexities of intellectual property and of patent filing put people off when actually it should be one of the first things they do when they're starting out?
I think the awareness of intellectual property has risen, you know, enormously in the last few years, but the actual understanding hasn't improved at all. And there is this misconception as to what it can do for you, how much it costs, and what you do need to do, and when.
Well, Peter, thank you very much. It's been very useful. I hope you've solved some people's problems there. And keep listening to Guardian Tech Weekly for our next Startup Surgery.
That was Jemima Kish with Peter Finney answering your questions about intellectual property. This was the latest in our Startup Surgery series. If you'd like advice on how to raise capital or need some other special legal information, then head over to guardian.co.uk/techweekly and discover entrepreneurial enlightenment in our archives. Now, here's Bobby with the news.
The role of communications and social media in Iran has been in the spotlight this week after continued unrest in the wake of the country's disputed elections. Last week, the US State Department urged Twitter to stay online to help get information out of Tehran, while millions of people witnessed the footage of the death of protester Neda Soltani online. After the release of the controversial documents containing MPs' expenses, The Guardian's readers joined in an effort to help break down tens of thousands of pages of data. An experimental online application built by The Guardian has so far seen more than 20,000 people analyse more than 160,000 pages of information, although huge chunks were blacked out of the original documents. Apple insists that Chief Executive Steve Jobs is set to return to full-time work at the company by the end of the month, despite reports that he received a liver transplant 2 months ago. The news, which has yet to be confirmed by Apple, would indicate that the 54-year-old's health problems are far more serious than he indicated in a statement in January. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown believes that the internet has changed foreign policy forever. In an exclusive interview with The Guardian, Brown said that the web era is causing a shift in power that's more tumultuous than any previous economic or social revolution.
So, Charles, Gordon Brown says that the internet has changed foreign policy. What does he know from the internet? I mean, do you actually think that he engaged with it, or that this is something that somebody else told him?
I think it's one of those things where he's been told it's a really good idea, and he's seen a lot of people using it, and they've sort of filmed him and said, and now, Gordon, you're on YouTube. Gordon Brown is, you know, a really long time, dyed in the wool, it's all done in the corridors, well, corridors of Westminster, corridors of Whitehall sort of politician. And I'm not so convinced that he completely gets the social media aspect to the way the internet works now. The extent that the internet has changed foreign policy, well, I'm not sure actually that our policy towards Iran or Iraq or North Korea has actually been changed at all by the internet. We can find out more things about them. We can get more feedback from the population. But in terms of how you run your realpolitik, I don't think that's altered at all. Politics just changes much more slowly, and it's very difficult for MPs, especially, and people right at the top of parties to really live it in the way they need to. That said, I think that David Cameron has shown an interesting preparedness to listen to these ideas, and Gordon Brown perhaps, but I think that it's just much more difficult for Gordon Brown to make the adjustment.
Talking a little bit more about the foreign policy implications, you suggested that it's just simply a matter that we know more, that this information is now more available because of all the different media channels. And certainly over the past week, the use of social media, particularly things like Twitter, to get information coming out of Iran, for example, has really had quite a lot of impact on how much information has left that particular area. But do you think that that these technologies are actually having an impact on the countries, the regions themselves?
The whole Twitter and Iran thing has had a much bigger effect on the reporting of Iran, possibly, than the people inside. But anecdotal suggestion is that inside Iran itself, it's still things like, phones and, speaking to people, which has a bigger effect than Twitter itself. The big effect of Twitter has been that it's much more visible to us that people are doing these things. And the web does give people within Iran the chance to, for example, upload audio booths or to upload video actually telling what their experiences are. So the whole thing of, needing foreign bureaus in Baghdad or needing foreign bureaus in Tehran becomes a little less important for the news organizations, because they can sort of, go to the crowd and the crowd tells them what the story is.
Well, you mentioned this idea of crowdsourcing. Yeah. And we've been doing some work with that at The Guardian.
The MPs' expenses came out in their fabulously redacted form. All these images, image basically PDFs, so that you couldn't get the data straight off them. You have actually got get people to go and look at the damn things. Simon Willison in The Guardian wrote, in the course of 5 working days, he wrote an entire crowdsourcing app written in Django, which is a Python-based web app with Amazon's Elastic Cloud Compute engine to do the back-end processing. And it has had an astonishing response.
Well, for more details on these stories and also to check out the app and all the up-to-date headlines, go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Audio Boo. It's the latest new media trend to capture the attentions of the digerati and a few celebrities too.
Well, the time has come for me to make my first recording. Audio Boo appears to be very simple, very intuitive, and let's hope this works. Welcome to my Audio Boo world, everybody.
That was Stephen Fry, of course, with his very first boo. Audio Boo is a technology that allows you to record snippets of audio using your iPhone and then to send it out to the world via the internet. And it's taken off in the past few months, from its very beginnings as a startup funded by 4IP to being used in high-profile news situations like the G20 riots. It's taken an unusual step recently, seeking cash from the crowd, sourcing the next round of development money from anyone who wants to invest a quick £10,000. But do we really need an audio microblogging tool? Jemima Kish met with Mark Rock, CEO of Audioboo, to find out. She also asked him a few difficult questions about their revolutionary business model. And she began by asking Mark why they started out as an application for the iPhone rather than as a generic web-based tool.
We're Mac developers, so it's the easiest platform for us to develop for. Two, obviously, the iPhone is an amazing device in terms of the capabilities. But we really see the iPhone app as it's almost a proof of concept. You know, we want to go onto other platforms, and we're exploring Nokia, all the other smartphone platforms that are out there. And in fact, for the iPhone, we will probably end up releasing the code in the form of libraries to anyone who wants to incorporate in their own iPhone app.
So how many users have you got so far?
Unfortunately, my API man's on holiday. Has been for the last 2 weeks. But before he left, we had, 35,000 registered users. We get, on average, we get one boo every 5 minutes in the 24-hour period.
Now, I know 4IP helped with funding at the start. Can you say how much money they gave you and what kind of support they gave you?
I probably can't say how much money they gave me, except that it was much less than the figures that have been talked about. Audioboo's being mainly financed by its holding company, Best Four Media, which has worked on it since October, really. In terms of 4IP, I think they put us onto the front page of the iTunes store. Probably about it.
Okay. I mean, they must have helped quite considerably get you audience and some traction when you were just starting out.
I mean, today I can't think of... I can only think one person within Channel 4 has actually used Audioboo, as opposed to the vast majorities in the BBC. We have found it difficult to get support from the general Channel 4 organisation. I mean, you would have thought Big Brother would be using it by now, for example, but that hasn't been the case.
Why do you think that is? Is that maybe symptomatic of just a big media organisation that takes a while to pick up on using new tools?
I definitely think both Channel 4 and 4IP have been probably startled at the success of Audioboo. They probably don't realise the complexity of what we've done and, you know, how difficult it is to make something that's very easy to use. But I think you'd probably have to ask 4IP that question.
OK. Now, I know you're looking at raising more money, but you've decided to do it in a slightly different way. Tell us about that.
The trouble with Audioboo, it's 3 months old. It's exploding like a rash. You know, there's still a huge amount of work to be done on it. The situation changes with the week. So, you know, we have deals on the table with people like Spinvox. We've got various different talks with operators. It's very difficult to keep the business plan up to date. So, you know, we thought that since Audioboo was such a social phenomenon, I think that is probably one of its success points, is that the people on it are a very, very rich, vibrant community, is, you know, one of the options we're looking at is crowdsourcing that funding, rolling it into a new company, putting 20% aside in 1% shares. And then, you know, we can fund the growth of Audioboo as we go along, rather than get a huge amount and have it sitting in the bank while we finish development. But we're looking at a range of options in that, you know, some interesting talks.
So how much would a 1% stake in Audioboo cost you?
I think yesterday we were saying 10 grand.
Okay, and what are you saying today?
Ask me tomorrow. I think actually we would keep it at that. I mean, we already had four and a half pretty serious inquiries, so, you know, that's going to fund a month's development.
So what do you get for your money then? I mean, at the moment, obviously, it's a free product, but you're looking at introducing a paid version.
Yeah, so the strategy for Audioboo is freemium, really. There'll always be a free product. It'll be limited in length and functionality. We've had a lot of people in the Audioboo community ask for more functionality, specifically the ability to queue uploads. So at the minute, you have to record, upload, record, upload.
I noticed that.
Yes, you might be in a dodgy area. So we're going to introduce a subscription version called Plus, which will be 36 quid a year, something Flickr-esque, and that will have stuff like queued upload, so you can record 15 boos, go to McDonald's, upload them on the Wi-Fi, ability to add more pictures, a number of different enhancements, a much longer time limit. There'll also be a pro version, so people like The Guardian would buy that. And that's really a set of kind of online management tools, so moderation, online editing, analytics, the kind of stuff that big companies got. And we've sold one of those to the British Library already, and that will be about 10K a year.
Why do you think Audioboo has managed to attract so much attention? I mean, it's an interesting startup, but London and the UK and, in fact, Europe are full of interesting startups. What is it about this audio tool that's managed to get people so excited?
I think one is just the simplicity of the application. I think one of the other things is that audio, particularly spoken word audio, has been really ignored in this kind of Web 2 madness. So the focus of audio has obviously been on music and, you know, companies like Last FM and, you know, about distribution. I think we've kind of rediscovered that radio niche, which is the ability to listen, to record stuff, which may be pointless, it may be amazing, you know, it's not up for us to choose, but the fact is that the cost of creation and distribution are practically zero. You know, you can record anything.
Where do you take Audioboo from here? You've said before that you really need to explore particular niches, and obviously it's been picked up by a lot of news organisations. But I think music's an interesting niche to look at as well, isn't it? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we have got quite a lot of musicians using it. I'm very interested in the kind of whole idea of the kind of birth of a song. So the process that comes up to recording that song, whether it's trying out lyrics, you know, talking to people about it, first notes, could be amazingly documented by Audioboo. And we are talking to some record companies and artists about that. In terms of Audioboo, we need to get it onto as many mobile platforms as possible.
So there's loads of interesting stuff in the pipeline. But really, this time next year, is it just likely that Audioboo will have been snapped up by some big media company? Is that secretly your hope?
I don't know, actually. I mean, the big plan for Audioboo is to kind of own audio in the sky in the same way that Flickr does for imagery. And if we can achieve that, that's, you know, by ourselves or with a big company, that's great.
That was Mark Rock from Audioboo with our own Jemima Kish. In terms of funding, do you think that really the power, the money behind the startup scene has been more in the direction of video? Or do you think that, you know, both are getting their fair slice of the pie, as it were?
I think it's always been hard to come up with a really good story to tell about audio. You know, how do you persuade the guy in the VC office or whatever that you got this new audio package and you can record this audio and therefore it's going to be great? You know, you would imagine they're going to say, well, okay, but why not add video? Then you got the choice of, you know, you can do the video and just have no picture. Then you got both.
Do you think that this crowdsourcing model is something that would fit with a new idea of how people should raise money or how people can raise money in this new startup scene?
Well, crowdsourcing money worked pretty well for Barack Obama. So, you know, that's not tried and tested, and that works. But I think £10,000, that's kind of a bit too high. You know, if he was saying £1,000 minimum, then I think there might be some people around who'd say, okay, I can do £1,000.
It seems to me like it kind of follows the Seismic idea. And as we've been saying, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, we were saying, well, where is Seismic now? Which is a sort of micro video tool where the idea as a Web 2 concept is that you record a short video of yourself asking a question or then responding to somebody else's question. And that's really where it happens. It seems to me that that's where Audioboo sits in this space. And as you say, it's very useful for people like broadcasters, but may have limited appeal for a wider audience.
My own feeling, again, is that people go for stuff that's nice and easy to do. It's easy to respond to. It's easy to, you know, take in, whether it's by reading or listening or watching. And they'll take the path of least resistance. And I think that audio actually has slightly more resistance in terms of, you know, the difficulty involved than just stuff like text.
Well, you can read up on the British funding scene, including things like freemium, which you mentioned before, Charles, and this crowdsourcing concept on guardian.co.uk/technology. What's been going on the blogs? Charles, what have you found of interest in technology?
I think this week was simply marvellous because it turns out we're both doing the same post, which I cross-posted between technology and the GameSpot. It arose out of the Digital Britain report, which was described as a great big policy mess of a policy mix stew or something like that. But it did have a wonderful suggestion about giving, in effect, tax incentives to companies which wrote, quote, culturally British games. And I wondered, well, what the hell do we mean by a, quote, culturally British game? You know, we suspected that it meant companies which are based in the UK and which, you know, write games here. But what if it actually meant games that are, you know, culturally British? What if it was GTA, Western Supermare? What if it was Left 4 Dead, you know, the Light Brigade? And so I asked people if they could suggest a few, and boy, did they. And this was just one of the most wonderful threads, I thought. So just a few that I picked out here. Enzo2, who was actually the first to respond, Call of Duty, Dad's Army. We had Homer, who pointed out that GTA London's already been done, but what about GTA London Victorian times, where you're speeding around at 10 miles an hour on a horse and cart? Foxtrot Yankee pointed out you could have GTA Milton Keynes, where it would be quite easy to load because it would be a just repeating grid pattern of straight road, roundabout, straight road, roundabout. Slabman pointed out that you could have Tom Clancy's Toast and Tea Recon and We Unfit.
I've also got a list of several that I think are very, very clever from our readers. But before I go into them, I think it's very important to point out that you should go to see this post just simply because of the picture that you put at the top of this, at the top of the post. It's absolutely wonderful. It's sort of circa, it's Western Supermare circa 1920 something or other. It's brilliant. Anyway, the ones that I particularly liked were, well, KJM had a longer post. He said he always thought that the Housers, who created GTA, should take GTA home, but I'm not sure if the world is ready for GTA Dundee. He says there's not a strong enough age classification system anywhere in the world that would be able to rate the content of that game. And for the record, Dundee, you are a lovely city, so please do not write in and tell us.
And we love your cake.
Lovely, lovely cake. I also liked God of Warwick. I like that one. Swedish rock star suggested Battersea Nintendogs Home, hey. Which was very good. And then Alan Evans said, absolutely fabulous.
Hey. But actually, I thought Swedish rock star who had World of Needlecraft.
Very good. Anyway, if you've got something to say and just have to say it or want to contribute your own British culturally significant computer game title, then do get in touch. For all the links that you need to contact us, head over to guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
In this week's technology section with The Guardian, we look into how Apple will fare after Steve Jobs and what it faces when he inevitably has to step aside from running it day to day. As spammers have been imprisoned, does this mean the end of spam? We find out, unfortunately not. After Intel's Futures exhibition, see how they envisage our cars will talk to each other by flashing their headlights very fast. And we review the new iPhone 3GS, look at how mobiles are being used in India, and how an air-powered lithium battery could last longer. It's in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to our guests, Peter Finney and Mark Rock. Cheers to our pod team, Charles Arthur, Jemima Kish and Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. Join us next week when we're going to talk about sex. Seriously.